This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sharad Kutan here with me. It's now 9:36 a.m. on Monday, the 6th of June. It's time for Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. This is the show that takes you beyond the headlines of the day with people who write the news, who make the news. Joining us on the show today is P. Gunasekaram, former editor of Kini Biz. He's currently an independent consultant, trainer and writer. Good morning, Guna.
Good morning.
All right.
Good morning,
so Guna. This morning, we're going to be discussing the PASA's President Hadi Awang's private members bill, or more commonly referred to in the media as the Hudud bill. It's a bit of a mouthful to say private members bill every time.
Well, private members bill is just a kind of bill, right?
Right.
So brought up not by the government of the day, but by somebody in the assembly. It could be from the government backbenchers. It could be from the opposition backbenchers, isn't it, technically?
Yeah. I think in this case here, I think the unique thing about this particular bill was that it jumped a queue 14 places from number 15 to number 1. And the motion for this was moved by the minister in the PM's department, Azalina Osman, who has said that the orders for this came from the top, which in this case was the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, you know, in the versions, the House Leader and Chief Whip, respectively. You know.
And to put this in context also, there have been other private members' bills that have never seen the light of day. I'm thinking particularly of Parti Socialist Malaysia's Social Inclusion Act. They tried to put that out. They wanted a debate on it, the idea of creating a Social Inclusion Act, a commission on social inclusion and stuff. But that never saw the light of day.
And this particular bill too, I'm not sure whether it's in exactly the same form or not, was also put up earlier by PAS. And had been sort of rejected by the government.
So,
no, it was never heard.
It was put out twice, I believe. Hadi had tried to get twice for this private members bill to be tabled, but he failed each time. So now that he has his chance, now that the bill has been pushed up, slated to take precedence over government business, he actually, in a shocking move, decided not for it to be tabled now, but instead to be debated in October in that parliamentary session.
Okay, so shocking or not, Guna, you're an old hand, you've been around, you've seen politicians maneuver, right? Could this have been done, with collusion in the terms of all the stakeholders, meaning the government of the day knew, had agreed with PAS to push this up, and PAS agreed not to actually have this debated because it would have created so much dissent within the Barisan National ranks?
Okay, definitely there was a collusion between PAS and UMNO to bring this bill forward. You know? That's very clear already, and nobody denies that. The other thing which is very clear also is long-established coalition partners of BN, Barisan National, were not aware of this bill, you know, that this was going to be put up on the agenda. And this included MCA, MIC, and Gerakan. So the question that arises is, why is the government, why is Barisan doing this right now? Is it why have PASA's previous bills have been just put on the back burner, and why has it been fast-tracked now? You know?
So that's, we can only speculate as to why, right?
Well, we had that analyst group that came out with a suggestion that this was precisely about the by-elections. This was to signal to the PAS faithful that UMNO was going to deliver on its promises that it was making, behind closed doors.
That was BMI Group, BMI Research, I think. It was a part of the Fitch Group, is a research arm of that. So, they said it was a purely political move. And, you know, Sharad, we've spoken about this before, how every time the debate for this arises, right? So every now and then you see the debate for Hudud popping up and then, fading out once again. And almost every time it's linked to a strategic event, or the timing seems to be rather strategic. So I don't know whether this time around we should be giving it the attention and the hype that it's receiving, or is this something that is just a political ploy? It's part of the House of Cards.
Yeah, I think if you, definitely there seems to be a connection with the Kolakangsa and Sungai Besar elections. So it's been sort of like timed to come out during that period. So I think most people will know that the new party Amana is facing its test in these two constituencies at the moment. So that's one factor to take into consideration. But if you just go beyond the why now and see whether this bill will be passed or not, you know, so that's the next question I think people should be asking.
The likelihood of it.
The likelihood of it is that it is passed. So if you look at the numbers, UMNO has got, 88 seats,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then PAS has 15, that's 103. So you would need 9 more for a simple majority of 112 in a house of 222.
Is it a question purely of numbers, Gunnar? If you look at the reaction of parties, even within the Barisan National, universe, as it were, from East Malaysia, from the peninsula, this seems to be a deal breaker in terms of the kind of social contract, right? So it's read in that way. We had we have Joseph Kurup saying the East might go its own way if this Hudud bill is pushed forward. So what we know is it's not a Hudud bill. It's a bill that allows Hudud to be practiced in the states where they have such legislation.
It increases the Sharia courts.
In the Sharia courts, you can increase it, right? Just stopping short of the death penalty, any other penalties can be introduced. So that is what it effectively means. So it started off as a backdoor way of introducing Hudud without actually changing the constitution, which will require 2/3 majority.
Can I just ask, the media and we are also guilty of this, often refer to it as the Hudud Bill. Is that an accurate representation of what this bill is? Because, if you talk about it, it's the amendments to the Sharia Courts
Act
1965, if I'm not mistaken, Private Members Bill. It's a long, it's a mouthful.
A lot of people see it probably justifiably so as a precursor to the introduction of heavier, Islamic elements into the current system of law. And there is an encroachment into the penal code area. You know? So there is a question of overlap of jurisdictions, the police on one side and the Sharia authorities on the other. You know, when does one take what action against somebody else? And what about, for instance, questions of theft? You know, Hudud provides for amputation of limbs, whereas the civil law does not. You know? So where does all this come? There is a whole lot of uncertainty over the whole issue. And there are some who think that even if the laws are passed, they will be anti-constitutional. So you can challenge the bill on the basis that it is against the constitution.
Well, some people are banking on the fact that people will not come out to rally against something that's overtly religious. So once you say it's religious, then it has an aura around it. People will be loath to say, I don't want something that is obviously related to the ideals of religion. Right?
Which brings us up to the next point. So will the bill succeed? And what if it does? So I think
What are the consequences for the economy, for how businesses run and how we imagine this country?
Well, we'll delve into that in just a couple of minutes on Pressing Matters, BFM 89.9. We're discussing this morning the Private Members Bill to amend the Sharia Court's sentence limitations and what this would mean if it is the likelihood of it being passed in Parliament and what it would mean for Malaysia.
So will it succeed is a question. I think if we just look at the numbers roughly, there are 88 UMNO members plus, passes 15 after the defection of 6 to Amana and PKR. So you would need 9 more for a simple majority of 112 in the House of 222. So, BN's ally in Sarawak is, of course, PPB, which has, 15 seats. So if PPB supports this, then they will get a simple majority. But Adinan has already come out to say that he will not support the bill, which has already thrown a spanner into BN's work. So.
Yeah, but again I come back to the question of the implications for Barisan Nasional as a coalition. Because the statements that were made after this move by Azulina was that, in fact, the consensus among the Barisan Nasional parties, they would not support this bill. They would never see light of day. The turnaround might be seen as a betrayal. If you look at the front pages of the Star, we had like words no, 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 and basically the consensus was at a party level, at a coalition level, that this was unacceptable.
But if you look at the numbers for the BN, the other BN component parties, if your PPB is the next largest with 15. And then you have, say, MCA with 7, and MIC with 4, Gerakan with 1. So leaving aside PPB, MCA, MIC, and Gerakan have a grand total of just 12. So and that is all that they have. So in terms of numbers, they don't really account for a lot.
Well, they've already said that the leaders of the coalition parties said that they would resign from cabinet.
And yes. The question is whether the coalition would even stick together, because the ability, if you think of MCA, right, that has campaigned very hard against the DAP, saying DAP's alliance with PAS in Pakatan Rakyat was in fact a sneaky way of getting Hudud and the Islamist agenda on the national agenda, right? And so that's been its campaign. If its main partner, UMNO, does exactly the same thing, yep. How it's raison d'etre, yeah. It would be destroyed.
Yes, but you see, that then comes back to, will there be an UMNO-PAS alliance? So you can't just, it's possible. PAS has been in the alliance government previously. So if they come together, then, that could be quite a powerful force which the opposition has to deal with. Right. And MCA and MIC and Gerakan will have to ask the question of whether there will be any meaning to remaining in the coalition anymore.
Right, okay. So when PAS did join UMNO, it was the reconstituted alliance post-69. It was a grand coalition of so many parties. And what we do know is that when PAS left that alliance, it actually suffered badly for being part of UMNO and the Barisan Nasional. So again, I think history will perhaps remind PAS that its alliances with UMNO have not generally been good for it. But to the extent you're right, it could be a new configuration for Malaysia. UMNO, PAS as the government of the day. But what does it do, right? So again, we come back to the question, a government that is made up solely of Malay Muslims, without the former ideology of a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional coalition that brings the whole country together with it. We've already seen these tensions within the federation. We've seen tensions in Johor. Will Johor accept this? The implications go beyond merely the question of being able to pass it because you have the force of numbers.
Definitely so, yes. The implications would be very wide, but the question is, okay, what if the bill is passed? And do you think it will be likely that it will be passed? Even if PPB has said that it's not going to support the bill, then there are others who might, this could be a bill which questions the person as a Muslim, for instance. So if you are a Muslim, Pakatan MP, for instance, whether from Amana or from PKR,
or
which
DAP.
Way are you going to vote?
DAP has two, if I'm not mistaken.
Or DAP, which way are you going to vote? Are you going to be seen in the public eye as a person who's not in favour of the Muslim law? So,
I want to put Hadi's position. Hadi's position is he's trying to solve the problem of crime. He says we have high levels of crime. This form of punishment or criminal justice system will in fact reduce crime. He's come out publicly. He said you can walk safe in the streets if we have hudud. That's his position. And he's not saying the nature of the country will change, and he's not talking about Sharia law being imposed on the entire country.
He's saying specifically for Kelantan.
The proponents are saying it's going to be limited to Muslims, because the detractors say that it's impossible to actually run a dual system like this. But anyway, whatever it is, Hadi's position is that it's really an issue-specific kind of initiative, and it's about crime. Do you think that when you look at Malaysia's position globally, especially with foreign investors and how they see it, do you think they will be concerned? Or they will say, well, okay, this is an issue. In fact, reducing crime would be good for business.
Well, if that is, we are making a huge leap in assumption here that the introduction of, say, hudud-like laws will result in a reduction in crime. You know, but there are two systems after all. So if you're a non-Malay, you can commit a crime, or non-Muslim, sorry, to be exact. You can commit a crime and your hands won't be chopped off. You know? You may go to jail for 1 week or 2 weeks or 6 months or whatever it is. So one cannot assume that the crime rate is going to drop as a result of this, especially in urban areas like Kuala Lumpur, for instance.
Well, let's just say if Hadi is correct, yeah, and we do see a drop in crime rate following hudud-like laws, but what is the trade-off, right? Is there going to be a trade-off for the economy? I don't know whether we've done enough studies or looked into what that would mean for the economy. Think about, all the Muslim Malays working in, you know, non-Sharia compliant sectors, perhaps serving, working as a wait staff in a restaurant that's not been deemed halal. Is that considered against hudud? Could be. I guess it's a question that really needs to be looked at.
It's also a question of perception about the country. Okay, is Malaysia going to be considered a moderate Muslim country anymore if you have hudud-like laws introduced in the country? You know, so how much would that affect foreign direct investment? Perhaps not much at the end of the day. So if you total up everything, the economy itself may not be very much affected, especially in the short term. But the perception of a country as a moderate Muslim nation which is successful economically may be affected.
So could we look at Brunei as an example of a country that, you know, instituted Islamic law, Sharia?
A bit tough because, I mean, Brunei, like a lot of the Arab nations, they have a tremendous amount of oil wealth, which has totally distorted the economy and makes it impossible to tell how well they would have done if they did not have the oil wealth. You know? So you can't equate, say, and say, oh, this is a Muslim country which is rich because it is Muslim. You know, in this case here, there is a lot of oil wealth as well. You know?
I think the other question that's perhaps a challenge to liberals and, you know, Democrats is to say, well, if this is the wish of the majority, shouldn't it be allowed? Can we argue against the aspirations of the majority who want to live a different sort of way, who think that the solutions to our social problems are not being provided for under the structures that exist and they need something radically different?
I think democracy is more than just majority rule and majority wishes. You know, the majority wishes can sometimes be very dictatorial and oppressive. You know, take the position of, Germany and the Jews at one time, for instance. You know? So the majority is not always right. You know? So I think a country runs by accepting certain principles which is enshrined under the Constitution. So anything that you do going forward should be in accordance with the Constitution and not in opposition to what was the original intention of the Constitution itself. So in this case here, there is definitely seems to be a huge minefield as far as the constitutional issues themselves are concerned. Two parallel systems of law, you know, moving away from what the Constitution intended to be a secular state to one which is ever more Islamic in nature, for instance. All these have to be taken into account.
In fact, we had that leak of a Jakim paper that suggested that ultimately the end game would, in fact, to have Sharia, the Sharia courts as the supreme framework in which all law and, in fact, all Malaysians are governed by.
They denied that, though.
They did deny it. And so did the Deputy Home Minister deny it, but it was cited and it was reported.
Yeah. So does this mean that because Hadi asked for a postponement in the tabling, the debate of this private members bill to October, does that mean we put a pin in this first and only get to discuss it and see the response and support that this bill might get in Parliament in October? Is that the case, I guess? Would that be fair to say?
It'd be very interesting. What's your guess, Gunnar? Because we've had PAS up in arms in previous sessions where they were told it were going, the private members bill was going to be put forward and allowed to be tabled, and they scream, you know, betrayal. That was their thing. Yep. Do they think they're going
I
to be?
I think anything is possible. You know, if the bill gets to tabling stage, you know, after the debate and things like that, almost you know, it is not inconceivable that it will get passed. You know, for instance, if you look at Kelantan. Kelantan, you know, passed the bill allowing hudud-like laws to be introduced in Kelantan, and this was unanimous in the state assembly, which means all the UMNO assemblymen, you know, to a man, voted for the bill. You know,
yeah, it's also very interesting. So, I read this also. You know, Haraka covered the visit of the Sultan of Brunei to Kelantan. He had a 3-day visit. You know, I don't know to what extent Brunei is supporting states in the region to push for what they have already adopted, which is Sharia law. So, you know, to what extent Brunei is backing this, whether it's, you know, financially or at least in sort of giving symbolic support to any of these moves of increased Islamization in particular states in the region. Mm-hmm.
Okay, unfortunately, we've run out of time. It's now 9:58. Gunnar, thank you so much for joining us on Pressing Matters today. Gunnar is the former editor of KiniBiz. He's also an independent writer and consultant now. We've got news coming up at 10 o'clock. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan for BFM 89.9.
When Stephen Hawking's speech began to decline, it became a problem.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.